Jenny Valentich is a journalist who uses her investigative skills to reveal the female experience of drug and alcohol addiction. Her work is brutally honest and revealing, not least because she also writes of her own addiction. Her book, A Woman of Substances. She's speaking with Jeff Wood, and she's God Forbid's Voice in the Wilderness.
Voice in the Wilderness.
I started drinking when I was 13 and didn't stop for more than 20 years. And really, I started that young because simply it was pain relief. I had a lot going on in my childhood that I had to deal with. And when I discovered alcohol, it was so soothing. You know, it was almost like coming home. It was this feeling of relief immediately. And in fact, women are thought to use alcohol for self-soothing quite a lot. And so it became this kind of a abusive relationship eventually, but a relationship indeed. By the time I was about to stop drinking, I was starting at lunchtime every day at work. I'd go to the pub and have a couple of glasses of white wine, and then I'd go back to the office. But throughout the afternoon, I'd keep nipping down to the food court and having, you know, a dirty martini or something very alcoholic tasting. I'd do that a couple of times to top up, and I'd take a bit of work with me so I could feel like I was still being productive. And then at home time, I'd run into the bottle shop at the nearest pub and pick up a traveller for the road, something like a miniature of vodka or gin, and then kind of bounce back home via every pub en route. So there was a pretty consistent level of alcohol in my system. I wouldn't say I was seeking a form of happiness. I did feel that I had almost a spiritual connection with alcohol. I found it meditative, actually. It sort of made me take me time. It was something I felt I was doing for myself. But ultimately, it was self-destructive. Even quite early on, it would worsen my depression. And I wasn't really connecting the dots and thinking, well, maybe this is something that's not good for you. I actually realized I had a problem probably around the age of 18. So I stopped for about 5 weeks, but I was so young to imagine a life without alcohol was impossible at that point. So it just kept going on and on. And then I finally got to the age of 34 and I was so tired of it. I was so tired of rolling with the punches and, you know, having to bounce back, and I just couldn't bounce back anymore. And I started to feel very much as though I were going to die. It was this very odd feeling of impending death that I couldn't really put my finger on. And so obviously something had completely changed and it was time to stop.
Jenny, in your addiction memoir, Woman of Substances, you describe various attempts to stay sober, mainly forms of self-help. Did they help?
Well, these were things I tried after I'd gone to AA and after I'd also gone to a outpatient service for counselling. So by the time I tried these self-help methods, I was very much on an equal ground, whereas before I'd been a person in crisis. So I think to try self-help things before seeking professional help is probably a bit tricky.
Give us an idea of some of the forms of self-help that you tried.
Well, I tried listening to hypnosis recordings. This was before I stopped drinking, and they were very much about positive affirmations, which just didn't sit well with me at the time because I was so filled with self-loathing and desperation that it just felt pithy. You know, I couldn't relate to it. I also tried emotional freedom technique known as tapping, which is when you sort of tap your meridian lines in your face and you say affirmative things like, even though I am flawed, I deeply accept myself. And I just wasn't ready for that kind of thing. I needed professional help first.
Well, it sounds like these experiences really point to the limits of self-help in overcoming addiction.
If you're a person in crisis, if you've got a serious addiction, then really you need to tackle the illness before working on your wellness. I stopped and I went to AA, which obviously offers structure and it offers peer support. And it really fills your life with this, with routine, and you get to move forward with peers who are giving you the benefit of their knowledge. And I think that's vital in the early days to either have something like that or use a professional service to really get back on your feet first.
Now, you had tried AA earlier. Why didn't you stick with the program?
Yeah, I tried it for 18 months. So I went to a lot of meetings. I didn't grow up religious. My family, I wouldn't even say they're atheists, actually, because they just didn't bother at all. So I found the central tenet of having a higher power, or what people would sometimes call a God of your own description, quite troublesome, because it's a real key point. You know, you're supposed to hand over your power to this higher power, and in effect you're sort of handing over any kind of sense of autonomy. And I think for women especially, once you stop using drink or drugs, you really need to sort of build your self-esteem and find your feet and have a sense of agency again. AA is definitely trying to be more flexible with spirituality these days. You have groups around the world now which are openly aimed at atheists or agnostics and free thinkers, including one in Melbourne. They won't annotate the official literature, that's a definite no-no, but they might say the Serenity Prayer at the end and remove the word God as they're saying it. I think self-help definitely has its place in the life of somebody who's experienced problematic substance use, but I think it's vital that, first of all, professional help is sought out, whether that be through counselling or through rehab or through an inpatient service. I think it's really important to get well and then focus on increasing that well-being. The most important thing is you might have an underlying trauma, for instance, that can't just be smoothed over with a happiness workshop. And I love happiness workshops. I've been to one myself, but I didn't go until I was 18 months sober, because anything up to that point, I had to just focus on getting better.
Can you just tell me briefly about the happiness workshop? What did that entail?
Probably, I don't know, a few hundred people, and we would practice exercises about viewing your emotions as the weather, say. So the weather is transient. If you're struck by an awful feeling, you can kind of imagine that as a cloud, and the cloud is eventually going to pass. I don't expect to be happy every day, and I think that's very unrealistic. I think the best we can hope for is a sense of security in ourselves and the acceptance that emotions and moods and hard times will come, but they'll also go. So it's a continuing project, really. It's a continuing work of maintenance.
Jenny Valentish, speaking with Jeff Wood. Her book is A Woman of Substances. Maria, did anything strike a chord with you there?
Admiration for her being on the journey over, I'm sure, many, many days, many, many months to finding a kind of centeredness for herself. But it reminds me that it really comes down to choice. You know, Evan making a choice to consider trying another way of living, the people who come to us for consultations asking, this isn't working, I'm asking for help, I'm asking for guidance, I'm asking for wisdom.
A woman I knew, a patient who had the most extraordinary compulsive gambling problem with poker machines, which we have here, you don't have them in the States, lucky you, was destroying her life, and she said she had no control. It was an addiction, she was gone, well and truly gone. She happened to work at a venue where there were poker machines. And I asked, do you use the poker machines there? She goes, no, I can't. It's not allowed for staff to use the poker machines. When I finish work, I go to the poker machine pub down the road and do it. So she's still choosing. It's just a different context for the choice. She chooses not to play the poker machines at her own work, and she has no trouble making that choice. But when she goes past the poker machine down the road, it's in that context that the choice becomes so overwhelming. And I want to ask you, Evan, would you describe the features of your life in your 20s as addictive?
Well, for me, I just, you know, I knew it was a never-ending circle of, you know, it wasn't really getting me anywhere. And it was only after I took the time to sort of realize why I did those things in the first place. I think that's why, you know, we jump into those things, because that's what everyone does.
Explain, if it was a compulsive cycle but not an addiction?
Well, I'm not too sure if it was an addiction. I don't know if I'd label it that way. So I think definitely here in Australia, it's just become so much part of the norm that I don't think 95% of people who go out drinking four times a week consider themselves to have an addiction. But I'm not too sure, to be honest.
You see, this is the thing. In Australia, you can drink almost every night or every night to high and unhealthy levels. But in our culture, that's Maria. That's not described as an alcoholic. You have one little touch of heroin, say, once a year, and, well, you're a junkie, a sick junkie, because we have within our culture differing understandings of different kinds of drugs, substances and addictions, which is not logical. Sue, I see you nodding.
I like to come back to what's happening in the brain around addiction. And again, I don't necessarily work with people with addiction. But the thing that we know around the brain is when we are, when we experience a reward sensation, we release dopamine. It's a neurotransmitter that sort of gives us that sense of reward and feeling positive and yay, isn't that great? So if I, for instance, like chocolate, even thinking about having some chocolate makes my dopamine go whew, and therefore it propels me to act, as in eating the chocolate. Then I get more of it when I have the chocolate, and then I think, oh, should I have another one? And that dopamine propels me to act again, to do it again. So our brain is almost sort of encouraging us sometimes to want more of the neurotransmitters, which is therefore making us repeat the behaviour. Then, of course, the behaviour becomes a habit.
Evan, can you relate to that in terms of your fear of boredom that you had, you described it as, and you want to fill the hole of boredom with various things?
You know, I actually took 9 months off. I gave up sex and alcohol because I really wanted to observe why I did it in the first place. And it was really fascinating because, you know, most of the time I go to a bar and without even thinking, I'll jump in and, you know, get involved in whatever anyone else is doing. A lot of the times it was, out of boredom and loneliness.
What do you mean? You mean searching for a sexual partner for the night?
Yeah, well, like if you're out at a bar and the boys are there, it becomes a bit of a ego sort of competition type thing. I don't know what the culture's like in different parts, but certainly growing up in Sydney, that's definitely the case. I think it comes down to fulfillment. I really had no meaning in any other aspect of life. I was planning my weekend's activities on a Monday afternoon because, you know, I didn't really have any great satisfaction in my work, and that just stems right through Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. You try to cover up these feelings, but you're running away from. Thich Nhat Hanh, he has a great saying that he says, you know, the trick is not to run away from your suffering. But I see all I ever did was that because you never want to feel it because it doesn't feel nice. And that's basically the pleasure trap I was in for quite a while.
Were you looking for affection in the company of women or love or lust release?
I don't think it was ever love or affection. I think it was, you know, to be honest, it's quite embarrassing actually talking about it now because, you know, if you asked me a couple of years ago, I would have thought it was amazing. I spent my time really wisely. And
I don't like to brag, but, you know, you need most of the fingers on one hand to count my tally. What are we talking about with you?
Is my mum listening to this?
She's not, almost certainly not.
Oh, I mean, that was north of, you know, 300, 400, so. And, you know, I was such a big ego, but I used to write it down too and keep a number and whatnot.
You were saying before that you don't see yourself that you had an addiction, but it's in the eye of the beholder. Yeah. This word is a label. On one level, that's a, you know, classic compulsive.
I guess the majority of people I hung out with were doing the same thing, so it was hard
300? There's only so many Saturday nights in your life.
There's also Wednesdays and Thursdays and Fridays. So.
You loved leap years as well.
What's funny, I think I spoke with you earlier about this. You know, I used to think that, you know, I'd sleep with all these people and would get out of my system. Like I had this idea of I'll just do it all in my 20s and then I'll be fine.
There must be some number I can reach where these feelings and this cycle will stop. Was that what you were thinking?
Oh, I thought that, you know, I'll get to a point where, oh, I've done that, I've experienced that part of life and now I can be content.
And the analogy, your brother, the Buddhist monk?
Yeah, my brother, he said, you know, you're just putting another log on the fire. And what happens when you put more logs in the fire just gets bigger and out of control. What you need to do is take the logs off the fire. You know, and that's what I started to do and became more at ease and content. Instead of just being like a puppet on the strings or a leaf that gets blown each and every way and lands wherever it lands, I had a bit more direction and control of what I was doing and where I was going.
Maria, being in a space like that before you find control, it can be very frightening and very,
very distressing. And I think it's more about stepping back and being reflective, as Evan has been, in terms of first realize what is it that I'm doing and why am I driven this way? And is it really getting me where I long to be or who I long to be.
But when we say the addict needs to have this self-awareness, addicts spend year after year thinking about themselves and hating themselves in the process and feeling fear and desperation. And it's not a lack of thinking about themselves that's the problem.
Self-focus is different than self-awareness.
Uh-huh.
I think you're talking about a distinction there. We can be focused on oneself in a tortured way, in a positive way, but awareness involves a stepping back, creating enough space to witness oneself as one truly is.